A very long time ago, long before the golden age of Greece, there was a highly advanced civilization that existed on an island. No one knows exactly where this was. Some people have said that it was, in fact, in the Atlantic Ocean. But in any case, these people were the naval power of their day, and they used technology that was equal to, maybe even rival to, our own. But in the space of a single day and night, natural disaster struck, and Atlantis slipped beneath the waves and soon thereafter from the memories of humankind. The story, as we have it, probably owes its origins to Plato, who included it in one of his dialogues. He claimed that it was true, although many who came after him believed that he had just made it up. It may be that Plato's story had a factual basis. Sometime around 1600 BC, a very powerful volcanic eruption devastated the island of Thera, north of Crete in the Aegean Sea. It was part of the Minoan culture, and indeed, from the evidence that's now being unearthed by archaeologists, it was indeed very highly advanced for its time. We'll be talking this morning about the work that's being done on Thera, and whether or not, in fact, it might be the seed of the legend which came to be widely circulated by Plato and other people, the legend of Atlantis. This morning, our guest in this first part of Focus 580 is Charles Pellegrino, and he has authored a book examining this topic. His book is entitled Unearthing Atlantis, An Archaeological Odyssey. It is published by Random House. It is one of a number of books which Dr. Pellegrino has written. He also has written for Smithsonian, Omni, Analog, and other popular and professional publications. His interests extend into a number of areas of science, archaeology being just one, and he's joining us this morning by phone. As we talk, you should feel free to pick up the telephone and call in if you have questions or comments. Our telephone number here, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers to call. Dr. Pellegrino, hello.
Morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us today. Tell us what Thera looks like today as you you approach the island by boat, as you walk around it. What kind of a place is it now?
Very much as Plato described it, they're basically what look from the air like broken ribs of bone, which is the outer fringe of the island. There had been a one-mile-high volcano in the center, and now there's just a few outer fringes and a crater 8 miles across and nearly a quarter mile deep. And originally, it was more than a half mile deep immediately after the explosion.
Mm. And I suppose that's one of the things that the fact that the way it really looks is much like the way Plato described it. One of the things that lends some credence to the idea that, in fact, Plato just didn't make the story up, but that that somehow the story had come down to him. Are there some other ways in which the things that Plato has written about his Atlantis do seem to square up well with the place as we, Thera, as we know it?
Definitely, and it's not just a matter of people fitting pieces into a jigsaw puzzle and kind of forcing them into place. Even before geologists learned that there had been an explosion, and before Spirit and Marinatos, the archaeologist who found the buried city on Thera, found a buried city dating back to the explosion that happened to be a Minoan city, which is the civilization that is believed to be the kernel of truth behind the origin of the Atlantis legend. Archaeologists very early in this century were digging down on the island of Crete below Greek ruins, and they found the ruins of a more advanced civilization below the younger classical Greek civilization. And this is it struck them immediately that this is exactly what Plato described. Mm-hmm. An older civilization that had died off for some reason, but there had been survivors who carried on the technology and passed it on to what later became the classical Greek civilization. And there were golden cups turning up that were exact on their outsides. They had engravings that were exact descriptions of bull ceremonies described by Plato and credited to the what he called the Atlantean civilization. And more amazing is these cups themselves had been described by Plato with the same bull ceremonies described on the sides. So it was people very early, about 1906, a researcher by the name of K.T. Frost had written that this could be the origin of the Atlantis legend. The one major thing that did not quite fit the Plato tale was that this older civilization had not died by some kind of volcanic eruption or a sinking, as far as they could tell in 1906. And so they felt that maybe there had been some sort of massive economic collapse throughout the eastern Mediterranean and that the civilization had vanished suddenly as if a lost Atlantis. And now we know that there was this tremendous, actually the most tremendous ecological disaster that humans have ever seen, up to the one that we are just about developing the capability of creating now.
The descriptions of this volcanic eruption are, it sort of boggles the mind to try to think about just how the size of the explosion, for example. You write in the book that this volcano exploded with the force of 150 hydrogen bombs.
Right,
really,
all
really
going
so?
Off in the same
at the same, place,
at the same,
same
instant. It was a truly global event. The amount of dust cast up into the upper atmosphere was such that in the stratosphere it was intercepting sunlight possibly for a year or two and decreasing the amount of sunlight getting down to the Earth. And this is recorded all over the Northern Hemisphere now in very old trees, in Turkey and in California even. You have scars from freezing of these trees in the summertime in June and July that in the California bristlecone pines that can be dated to 1628 B.C. Actually, 1627 B.C., which is one of the things that dates the explosion to 1628 B.C.
Apparently, it had previously been thought that the decline of Minoan civilization was, well, I guess nobody really knew. I suppose some people thought that there was that it was a result of warfare, that invaders came from somewhere else, and that was why there was this precipitous decline and disappearance of this culture. And apparently now it does seem to be the fact that it was this. That it was this natural disaster, and it was serious enough. Apparently, it would have caused enough destruction. It could have killed enough people, so that in a very short space of time, you could have the decline of what was a very dominant and very powerful culture at the time.
Right. It appears to have been, and the final piece of that puzzle was when a Minoan city was found under the volcanic ash. And from what can be seen on Crete and the migrations of peoples, not only in Crete, but throughout the entire Mideast at that time, complete havoc. You have written records in China of the false winters and summer and famine throughout the land in the northern provinces, man becoming as a man-eater, and much closer on the island of Crete, we can only imagine what the effects were. And Crete was the center of Minoan civilization. Evidently, you had tremendous crop failures, failure of the tuna fish populations, a main staple for food, and what would have resulted in first an environmental collapse, certainly a tremendous economic collapse following that. And as Plato describes it, you had some sort of collapse. You had people who were still around, and then Greeks came in from the north. And this is exactly what we see archaeologically, the Greeks moving in. The Egyptians record the changeover of government as the Greeks moved into Crete and the other Minoan centers, and basically employed the Minoan architects and so on to build new palaces, new temples.
Mm-hmm. Let me just reintroduce for our guest here for people who may have tuned in. We're talking with Charles Pellegrino. He is the author of the book Unearthing Atlantis, an Archaeological Odyssey. It's fairly recently been published, and if you're interested in calling in here, you have comments, questions, give us a call, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. The effects of this volcanic eruption were so widespread. Well, you've talked about the fact that it shows up in the evidence on the North American continent. The Chinese talked about it. One thing that's particularly intriguing, certainly the Egyptians were close enough to have some fairly dramatic, to experience some fairly dramatic effects. You think perhaps that might be the basis for the plagues that are documented in the Old Testament?
Right, and also documented in one papyrus in Egypt, and in almost the same language as the Old Testament. It refers to darkness throughout the land of Egypt. It refers in the same language to not being able to leave the temple for a certain number of days. The number of days differs from the Old Testament, but the language is the same in saying that you could not see the shadow of the person next to you, even though the person was right next to you. There's reference to plague and pestilence. And the Egyptians also record at this time the changeover of government on Crete. And so it's one of the things that at least we don't see any evidence archaeologically yet that of an Exodus and of a Moses and any of that at this point, but we do see that some of the things that seem very odd in the Old Testament appear actually to have occurred. The ash layer has actually been found in Egypt and can be dated on the Nile Delta to 1628 B.C. Daniel Stanley at the Smithsonian is the person who first found this ash layer. And this all helps us to date at least the plagues of Egypt to the reign of the pharaoh Thutmose III, actually to around the time of the co-regency of Thutmose III and his stepmother, Queen Hatshepsut. So, which would, if one takes literally the biblical descriptions, which don't describe who the pharaohs of the Exodus were and the pharaohs of the oppression, one of those pharaohs would have actually been a woman. Rather interesting.
One of the things that I had wondered about is that when you think of the power that and influence that the Minoan culture must have had in its day, how it is that it managed to disappear so completely from, not only was the physical evidence gone, but it seems that within the historical record there's very little, so that when fairly recently it was rediscovered, it was sort of a surprise.
Well, there are echoes of Minoan civilization in the Iliad, the Argosy, and the Odyssey, and descriptions of the Minoan gods and ceremonies and so on, and palaces, they do appear. And even in the Odyssey, there's a description of the civilization as described by Plato, but they're not called Minoans or Atlanteans at that time, and that there was some sort of calamity that these people had disappeared. So there are echoes of it throughout later Greek civilization.
Hmm. Apparently, the first person to do work on Thera and to identify that as a place to work was this Greek archaeologist you mentioned, Spyridon Marinatus.
Right, right.
What was it that attracted him to Thera and decided that was a good place to look?
Excavations on Crete that were revealing that there had been cities washed over by tidal waves or something of that sort. He was finding huge blocks. Building stones, foundation stones to buildings, where the top half of it would be gone, and he'd found the upper half of one of these blocks about 200 or 300 feet away. And he was wondering, gee, if someone had come through here and invaded this city, he could understand them setting it on fire or doing something or looting or what have you. But people who come into cities to rape and pillage don't take foundation stones apart and cart the upper halves hundreds of feet away. And looking toward the island of Thera, which by then had been identified as a volcanic crater from some sort of explosion, he began to imagine maybe a tidal wave came from that direction, and maybe he could find a Minoan city somewhere under that island.
Mm-hmm.
And he went, and I know other archaeologists who've worked with him in the past. They said he was one of the most intuitive archaeologists. He really followed his intuition, and it was a very lucky strike. He found one stream valley on the island of Thera and said it would be logical for the people to have built here on the southern shore, getting the sunlight during the, you know, the most sunlight during the winter and everything. And the first place he dug, he found buildings. He ended up uncovering a whole city that is now known to be almost a mile across. With our present means of excavation, it will probably take another 300 years to fully excavate this city. One square block has been excavated so far.
Mm. It's really sort of remarkable when in the way that you describe him. He does seem to have been able to picture in his mind the way things were back then. He was the one who, as he looked at the evidence, sort of decided that perhaps that it was, in fact, there was this volcanic eruption. It did cause this particular kind of destruction. That perhaps was what had happened to the Minoans, and it was not man-made, but natural disaster. He seemed to know where to look. He seemed to have this ability to look at the evidence and then in his mind imagine what must have taken place.
Right, and actually walk among ruins and be walking through a living city in his mind's eye.
Yeah.
And I've heard that description from people who worked with him, from his daughter, from a few archaeologists in Israel, that he had a way of really bringing the past alive. You would be walking with him and you would no longer be walking with him through ruins. I've known one paleontologist like that, too, one of my teachers, who we would be walking through phosphate pits and or through clay pits in New Jersey, and we were no longer walking through a clay pit with a few fossils in the walls. We would actually be walking through a 70-million-year-old forest, as this guy started talking. You felt as if you were really walking through the past when you were tracing a stream bed to where deposits of amber might lie.
Hmm. Well, if you go and you walk around this space that has been excavated, this portion of the old city, what will you see? Take us for a little walk and describe what
you
they have found.
See the foundations of the first and second stories of buildings that were in fact up to four stories. Some of them may be five stories high. And you're walking through streets that do not look at all unlike the streets on the island today. Near some of the buildings would not look out of place at all among modern oceanfront condos on the island of Thera. And the street plans are basically the same, dictated by the geology and geography of the island and the winds. You find buildings that they had stairs going up to upper floors. They were riddled with plumbing. They had flush toilets. They almost 4,000 years before flush toilets were supposedly invented. It's possible that they might have actually been venting steam from the from volcanic vents through the pipes in the houses to heat them in the wintertime, and also to condense water up on the roofs for toilets and showers and bathtubs, which you also find in the houses. Very, you know, standard of living that was really unsurpassed. The Minoans on the island of Crete, they had a sewage system to rival the Los Angeles sewage system today. They, unlike the Egyptians, who whatever excess profits came out of their economy, tended to build huge monuments to themselves and giant tombs and so on, the Minoans appear to have put most of their excess income into large civil works projects, such as sewage systems, warehouses. I mean, you find warehouses like you find nowhere else in the ancient world, and recently the world's first dam has been uncovered, and it's Minoan.
Hmm. This morning we're speaking with Dr. Charles Pellegrino. He's the author of a book entitled Unearthing Atlantis, an Archaeological Odyssey, which is about some of the archaeological work that has been done in the Aegean on an island called Thera, which a long time ago was destroyed by a very powerful volcanic eruption somewhere around 1600 BC. It was part of the Minoan culture, which was the very powerful culture at the time, very powerful naval power, and one that went into a precipitous decline around that time, and it appears now that was the reason. It was the eruption of Thera. Also, it seems that it might have been the beginning of the story which has come down to us as the story of Atlantis, about this place where there was a very highly evolved civilization but was destroyed by natural disaster. Those people who brought us that story, Plato among them, may in fact have been remembering what had happened to Thera. So that's where the title of the book, Unearthing Atlantis, comes from. And we have a couple of folks here with questions, and anybody else who would like to call in certainly is welcome to do that. 333-WILL is our local number, 333-9455. And we also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere you can hear us, and that's 800-222-WILL. Well, we have a caller here on our toll-free line. We'll talk to them. Hello?
Yes, good morning.
Uh-huh.
I have a comment and a question. The comment I have basically is this. In reading Plato, he is very adamant and very straightforward about the general size of the population of Atlantis in its prime. And basically, he's talking about 63 million inhabitants, okay, which when I read that number, I had to read it twice because basically in my mind it bespeaks of a technology and society which is has a very well-developed distribution system, well-developed finances, because you just can't support 63 million people in an agrarian, nomadic, pick-your-berries-way-through-the-woods type technology. The other thing, the question I have for your guest is this. In thinking about the Minoan culture, my general thoughts on it, and I want to know if maybe you've thought about this also, would be that they are the a later byproduct of possible surviving Atlanteans after the demise of the main culture. Okay, and what I'd like to do is maybe hear a comment or two on that regarding that, or if anybody else has had that thought also.
Well, the first settlers of the islands that became Minoan appear to have come down from Turkey.
Uh-huh.
And there are, of course, in the Atlantis tale, as told by Plato, certain embellishments which would have been common around 350 B.C., and we're talking about an event that was passed down probably mostly through oral traditions, and Plato was telling a cautionary tale, so he made the Atlantean civilization larger than Libya and Asia put together. He, as there was a tendency among the classical Greeks to place mythical events into the Atlantic Ocean opposite Gibraltar, on the other sides of the Pillars of Hercules, which is Gibraltar.
Well, I've got a question for you.
Move the map there. So there are certainly some embellishments in the tale that, although there are other things like these very specific descriptions of these golden cups and bull ceremonies and the crash of an earlier civilization that through its technology and through its survivors gave rise to much of what became classical Greece, things fit in very, very close. And now the natural catastrophe at the time that this civilization fell also is another giant piece of the jigsaw puzzle.
Well, I've got a question for you then. What about the canals that they talk about? I guess there were a series of 10 circular canals with intersecting lines that would look similar to a wagon wheel with spokes, and that each of these canals was approximately what they called or referred to as being 10 strata in width, okay? And from what I've been told, I guess 10 strata is roughly equivalent to a mile.
Hmm.
Also,
well, if you look at the present geography of the island, it looks somewhat, you have a ring of islands, and you have, even after the explosion, you would have had smoke or something bubbling up from the center where there had been a mountain, which the Egyptians, when they first explored the wreckage of Thera, found that there had been an island. It was gone. They wouldn't have imagined that it blew into the stratosphere. It must have sunk. But that you do have sort of like this bullseye, these concentric ring images that are the remnants of the island and could have grown up as part of the legend, and even later on Crete being part of the crescent-shaped Crete being part of this concentric system.
What about the 63 million inhabitants that Plato talks about, though? I mean, if that's an exaggeration, where would he come up with that particular number?
Who knows where the number would have come up, even putting the island 9,000 years before Plato's time, the civilization of Atlantis, where actually it was a little more than 1,000, and some people say that it could have been misplacing of a number. And I think people have, some of the scholars who've said, oh, this number might have been mistranslated, and then you get $9,000 years before Plato if you translate it properly.
Uh-huh.
I think they're focusing too much attention on what need be explained only as embellishments. There's no evidence that any large landmass of any sort ever sank below any part of the Atlantic Ocean suddenly. Thera is relatively small event compared to what the Atlantis, a continent sinking to the bottom of the Atlantic would have been, and yet Thera disrupted life in the entire northern hemisphere, and even now with new scanning equipment, when you look at the ocean floor around Thera, you see that this thing tore up the entire eastern Mediterranean. There are cracks radiating out from this big blowhole in the earth that's 8 miles across.
Really?
One of these cracks goes along the sea floor for almost 100 miles.
Wow.
In Turkey, you find channeled scab lands that go 30 miles inland. And
that's
we've
amazing.
Done some modeling of what that tidal wave would have been like. It was focused very high in Turkey. It was, you know, a tidal wave depends on the shape of the shoreline, and here the tidal wave got stuck between two peninsulas, almost as if between the prongs of a tuning fork.
Uh-huh.
To move 30 miles inland, it had to be 800 feet when it reached the shore.
That's amazing.
Which is halfway up the Twin Towers, or 200 feet over the Washington Monument.
That's amazing. Can I ask you one more question? You're familiar with the Krakatoa?
Yeah.
Volcano. In magnitude of size, how many times greater do you feel that this volcanic explosion was than Krakatoa?
Oh, at least 8 times. Krakatoa was, and Mount St. Helens, those volcanic eruptions were on a scale of the way the Earth might be imagined to measure things. They were rather loud hiccups, whereas Thera would have, by comparison, been a major coronary.
Really? That's amazing. That's an interesting show you guys are hosting. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Let's go on here. We got somebody on our line number one to talk with. Hello.
The Greeks placed everything outside the Straits of Gibraltar, and the word was Atlantis, and that became the Atlantic Ocean. I'm just wondering if what the origin of the word is, and why the Greeks kept placing everything that far away. I guess that's because their sphere of influence was the whole Mediterranean. And
well, Atlantic and Atlantis don't seem to... Atlantis, the name, is evidently not derived from Atlantic Ocean, judging from the work of some people who've looked at these. The Atlantis might derive more from the, and possibly even Atlantic, from the Atlantis tribe in northern Africa. And what was the other question about?
Well, it was just the Greeks placed everything out of the Straits of Gibraltar.
And why would they place things in the Atlantic? Pretty much with the new mythologies we create today, if you imagine, for instance, Star Trek The Next Generation, which is... you know, who knows what people might think of that looking back 2,000 years from now. But space is the new infinite realm and seems almost endless, so we put a lot of mythical events out there in the into space. The Atlantic Ocean was to the classical Greeks much as space is to us today. No one knew what was on the other end. No one knew how far it went, and it was a place to put things. Just as today we have space shuttles and so on that are just beginning to probe space, and we've flung robots out there, and it's a nice place to put our new tails. And you'll notice if you watch some of the science fiction today, some of these new stories that are told and placed in space are actually based on ancient mythology, and we've taken ancient oral traditions and retold them in a larger scope.
I guess I would like to pursue, I guess maybe then Atlantic is sort of the Roman word, and Atlantis would have been what we, and how we translate or interpret Plato's. I wonder if he would be the first user of it, and it just seems it's a fair coincidence that Atlantis and Atlantic are so similar, and I mean, it's possible there are a lot of those kind of etymological things. I wanted to mention a book by the late Asimov, just in, it's sort of along the same lines. He did A Guide to the Old and New Testament, and what he does is he goes through the Bible and looks at the oral tradition, and then looks at other sources, Flavius Josephus, and people who were other texts, other histories, and sort of tries to take the stories in the Bible and show how that they're like condensed over generations and reinterprets it. It's an interesting work. I don't know how.
Yeah, viable. Very good book, by the way.
Is it?
And he's written about three or four books about the Bible, mm-hmm. and they're very, very interesting sources.
I'm wondering
if many people know he's written books on all. He's the place you go to if you want to get a an analysis of Shakespeare. His books on Shakespeare are also fascinating.
I guess he wore out five typewriters a year until he got a word processor.
Something like that.
I'm wondering if
he was writing a book a month. About a book every month.
The Minoan civilization had probably an opposing civilization, and I'm wondering if the natural catastrophe that wiped it out was sort of, we don't know much about Carthage because the Romans succeeded, and they seem to have gone way out of their way to wipe out any trace of Carthaginian civilization to a large extent. And I'm wondering whether this kind of thing, in fact, the way Plato was telling it as a cautionary tale, was he like saying there was a moral judgment and that the Atlantans were practicing evil things, or is there any kind of dynamic?
No, there isn't any background, any archaeological evidence that these were an evil or violent civilization. Quite the opposite. Unlike the Egyptians and the Mesopotamians and the Greeks, we, judging from their artwork at least, we don't see signs of violence. We see men jumping over bulls and carrying out some rather odd bull ceremonies, but we don't see people going out spearing animals in every which direction and putting spears through each other and propping each other's heads up on stakes, the sort of thing we see everywhere else in the world. When we look at the paintings in the average Minoan home, we see animals at play, ladies gathering flowers, and events like that.
Yeah, I wasn't suggesting that they really were evil. I was just suggesting that
There seems to be a tendency when a city is destroyed or something that people feel, well, in a just universe, things like that don't happen unless they brought some kind of evil upon themselves. They must have been doing something wrong.
Yeah, and is that included in some of the histories written by the people who, the civilizations that survived, or? I mean, are you seeing any of that in Plato, even?
From a standpoint of the Greeks who kind of went in and took over, too. But I think what we see more there is a tendency of trying to justify random evil in the universe or random events or disasters, that the victims tend to become villains because they're victims, and victims because they're villains after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
People said that even after the destruction of St. Pierre in 1902 by the explosion of Mount Pelee, and it was said, the people of this city that was destroyed, 30,000 people killed in a few seconds, They practiced voodoo, and that's why that was God's vengeance upon them. Almost any city that's destroyed by some disaster like that, someone will say something along those lines.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. A little while ago, we were talking about the progress of the excavation work on Thera, and if I had remember this right, in 20 years of work, they managed to uncover one city block.
Right.
And at that rate, they think it'll take 300 years to do the whole thing.
Right. Of course, what's not being taken into account is we're now able to CAT scan the ground and see buried buildings before any excavation actually begins. And during the next two or three decades, we're going to see more and more. I don't doubt that we will see the introduction of robots into archaeological digs and nanotechnology and all that sort of thing. So it's possible that somewhere down in about three decades, the excavations could start going much, much faster. And I've been working with Jim Powell at Brookhaven National Labs on ideas on how we should best display a city like this, because it is one of the great archaeological treasures of the world, this buried city on the island of Thera. It's been very, very well preserved by the same volcano that destroyed it, ironically enough.
Well, is there any doubt that the money might be there to actually do the work?
At the time, there are very strange things that go on with funding on the Greek islands, and often money goes into it vanishes before it ever gets to the place it's supposed to get to. And this is one of the great dangers to the site at this point. The site is not being very well maintained. Parts of buildings have begun to crumble to dust. I remember the chief archaeologist there weeping in front of me, saying that at one point we were talking about how it might actually have been better had we left this city buried as it was, where it was at least protected. But the attention that's being focused on it now, I think, is going to start changing some of that, at least making sure that no more damage occurs to the city, and eventually that a proper protective roof is put over it and reconstruction and proper display for tourists. I mean, it's a fascinating place if properly displayed. Parts of it are under as much as 200 feet of volcanic ash, and when you remove that ash and you reconstruct it, in the historic context of a city that is still underneath the surface of the earth, it can be quite fascinating to walk through something like that.
Hmm. Well, we have about 10 minutes left, and again, our guest is Charles Pellegrino. We're talking about his book, Unearthing Atlantis, An Archaeological Odyssey, and we have several people to talk with, so we'll try to get them all in here. Line 4 is our next caller, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hi, I got a couple of questions. Before I ask my questions, let me comment. You mentioned the plague of total darkness that fell on Egypt, and the Bible does record that was a plague of darkness that was so total that you could feel it. However, it also says that the places where the Israelites lived had plenty of light. And let me ask you about a couple of myths that have grown up around the Minoan culture. The first one is the Nazi myth, which said that the so-called master race had originally been Atlanteans. In other words, the Atlanteans were the first Aryans. Have you certainly have come in contact with that myth, have you?
Oh, that's nutcase in the 1800s wrote something about that effect, that they were a superior race. I forget, Donnelly was his name. Atlantis, the Antediluvian World. He wrote a very racist book along those lines. He had a lot of other odd ideas, that all of Shakespeare's plays were written by William Shakespeare and so on.
Yeah, and then there was...
He was a U.S. senator, too.
There was a Madame Bavansky and a Vito List that wrote a magazine called Estara, and Adolf Hitler collected magazines called Estara, and he got a lot of his, as I understand, got a lot of his ideas about the master race.
Right. Hitler was very much into mysticism at some point, and in fact, it was interesting. At one point, the British realized that he was consulting astrologers, and they found this out through channels that Hitler was consulting astrologers, and so the British then got the best astrologers they could to figure out what Hitler's astrologers were telling him, and that's one of the things that led to a successful Normandy invasion, because they knew that his astrologers would be telling him that Normandy would not be invaded, that would not be the place to be hit, it would just be a sort of bluff so you don't have to put many troops there.
But the basic idea of the Atlanteans, or the Atlanteans, it was that somehow the Atlanteans, being supermen, had inbred with lesser humans, and thereby had polluted their
That's all part of the modern mythology surrounding it, and some of it of a racist origin and so on. That's something that came up in about the 1850s, and it just has no relation to anything Plato was writing about.
And finally, let me ask you about the modern feminists have a goddess cult faction, which worship the same snake-handling gods depicted in Minoan frescoes. I'll hang up and let you...
Well, the snake-handling goddess is depicted in a Minoan statue, not in Minoan frescoes, and it's a statue that might not have ever been handling a snake at all. It was just something that in hindsight, it appears to be a statue that was very badly reconstructed with a lot of imagination put in. And it might not actually represent what the statue originally was to begin with.
Okay, let's go on. Line one is next. Hello.
Am I line one?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, good morning. This is Dr. Richards. I have a request for some information here. First, a little entertainment for you all. When I first tuned in, it sounded to me like you were maybe doing the equivalent of a Trekkies meeting about the past instead of a Trekkies meeting about the future. But now I understand that you're talking about something about reality here of which I know almost nothing. What country was this in? What date are we talking about?
We're talking about the eruption of Thera in the eastern Mediterranean.
That's a volcano?
It's 1628 B.C. And that evidence comes from tree rings and sediments on the Nile Delta, looking at the Greenland ice cap and radiocarbon dates, of course, which bracket the tree ring dates. So it's pretty well fixed in date.
You've anticipated my third question there. Thera is the name of a volcano?
Right. And the island is also called Santorini, too.
Where is that island?
It's 70 miles north of Crete.
So this fantastic culture was all on one little island? Or?
Oh, no. It was a culture that dominated pretty much the eastern Mediterranean. One Minoan site has just been found during the last year and a half. It's now being excavated on the Galilee. They had vigorous trade with Egypt, and in fact were the only civilization that the Egyptians referred to as civilized.
I see. Has anybody figured out what made them great?
They had the world's first navy, and they were able to very easily maintain control over their islands, and they kept the Greeks in the north pretty much at bay until they were weakened by a natural disaster and subsequent economic collapse, evidently.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll sign off with two little questions. How do you spell the name of the volcano and the name of the island in their day?
Oh, we don't know what what these people actually called themselves. The Egyptians called them the Keftu.
How do you spell that?
K-E-F-T-I-U, I think.
Okay.
My spelling is not always that good.
Okay.
And the island has been known by later names such as Thera, which means fear, and also Santorini, which is a more recent name.
So there's a body of thought that calls the island the same as the volcano, because I guess it originally started as just a volcano, and its lava made the island, as apparently happened in Hawaii.
Right.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, we have time for another caller here. We'll go to line number two. Hello.
Hi. We visited Sierra in 84, I guess, from Crete, and I kept looking for this volcano as we approached it by ferry boat, and when I finally realized that we had gotten to it and we were in it, I was just astounded at the scale of it.
Right. You can mention it. That was the thing that struck me. My first approach to Thera was by boat. And you can rattle off numbers off the tongue, 8 mile diameter, but until you're sitting in a boat in the middle of this thing and imagining there had been a mountain almost a mile above you, and everywhere where you're seeing water there was a mountain and cities and streams and everything, and it's gone. It stops you dead.
Well, it's even a new volcano coming up in the middle of the crater.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and you can take boats out to it and walk around on a building volcano. What is the name of the excavation that you're talking about?
That's named after the town that the excavation is taking place under, and it's Akrotiri. It's on the very southern shore of one of the fragments of the island of Thera.
So is that the one that would have been open to the public in 84?
Yeah, and on certain days it's open, and they walk people through the streets.
Yeah, okay. You know, it is very interesting to be there, and you can visit it, and it is readily accessible. And I would suggest that if people want to go, that they go, but not in August, because the whole world is there in August.
Yeah. There's
no place to stay.
The tin roof over the site is very interesting, too, because it gives somewhat that impression of a city, almost as if you're walking through a cave that has a city on its floor, almost as if you are walking under the earth.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it gives very much that feeling of the final scenes in the James Mason movie, Journey to the Center of the Earth. Everything but the Bernard Herrmann music.
I thought it was interesting to read Rihanna Eisler's book called The Chalice and the Blade, and it refers to the Minoan culture and, among other things, talking about what life might have been like in terms of social organization as an alternative to the kind of thing that we think of as being the way history was, with males dominant and war, and it's hard to summarize real quickly, but I do recommend that book. I think we've had WILL has had her on as a speaker. It's readily available in paperback and really, really interesting, talking about some interpretations of some of the...
Yeah, that is one of the things that we get from the paintings on Crete, for example, is that women evidently did share power with men in Minoan civilization, which would have been a first, except for Queen Hatshepsut in Egypt, but then they defiled her tomb and everything after she died. And she really had to fight to stay in rule, and in fact, she just barely managed by dressing up as a man and wearing a false beard and everything. But we don't see traces of those same types of difficulties in Minoan civilization.
And with regard to there was a couple callers ago was talking about goddess worship and snakes and so forth. There's some interpretation of that in there, too, including information in the Bible about the arks of the covenant, for instance, originally carrying a bronze snake. I thought the whole thing of interweaving of symbols and was helped tie in a whole bunch of different bits of information that I kept running across. Thanks very much. You've been very interesting.
Thank you for the call. Well, we're at the point, unfortunately, we're going to have to stop. However, it is a very interesting book, and I would recommend that anyone who is interested speak to take a look at it. The book is entitled Unearthing Atlantis. It's published by Random House, and it's recently come out. And the author, Charles Pellegrino. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Pellegrino, for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me on.